Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. South Korea's nuclear energy industry has for decades been facilitated by close cooperation with counterparts in the US, and during this time work has been conducted under what is known as a 1-2-3 agreement. Today, South Korea's power program supplies roughly one-third of the country's power, and the country has begun a concerted effort to break into the nuclear export market. But as South Korea's nuclear power industry has grown, so too is its desire for peaceful nuclear sovereignty, something that would entail their acquisition of domestic reprocessing and uranium enrichment facilities. A problem arises from the fact that the current US-South Korea nuclear cooperation agreement limits Seoul's capacity to acquire the sensitive nuclear technologies required for both reprocessing and uranium enrichment. However, because that treaty expires on March 19, 2014, Korean policymakers are currently negotiating with American colleagues to change the terms of agreement. To date, the US has opposed South Korea's requests on grounds of general non-proliferation policy and the complications that such activities might pose for other security issues on the Korean Peninsula. On the other hand, South Korea needs to find a solution to its nuclear waste problem and hopes to join the ranks of US allies like Japan and India, trusted with enrichment and reprocessing technologies. With scope for potential disagreement, the two parties are running out of time to find a mutually satisfactory solution to the dilemma, and even after any updated 1-2-3 agreement is filed, it must sit before Congress for 90 days, with time reserved in case of complications arising during the review process. As debates continue to swell about South Korea's needs to renegotiate the terms of its nuclear agreement, Korean Context decided to speak to four experts familiar with the issue to find out more. Mark Holt, a specialist in energy policy at the Congressional Research Service, Mark Fitzpatrick, a non-proliferation expert at London's International Institute for Strategic Studies, Gordon Flake, the executive director at the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Foundation, and Dr. Song-ho Shin, an assistant professor at the Graduate School of International Studies, Seoul National University. To start out, I asked Mark Holt why the agreement for peaceful nuclear cooperation between South Korea and the US was even expiring in the first place.
Okay, well, under the Atomic Energy Act, which is the basic law that in the United States that really controls all uses of nuclear materials and nuclear technology, it is very specific that any cooperation between the United States and any other country requires an agreement on peaceful nuclear cooperation. And the types of activities that are covered are listed specifically in the Act. That would be including the licensing of exports from the United States of special nuclear material, which includes nuclear fuel and enrichment services, direct U.S. foreign government supplies of technology and material, which was more significant in the earlier years when the U.S. government really controlled most of the technology and materials. And then the direct or indirect production of special nuclear materials outside the United States, that would be generally technology transfer and services as opposed to physical components. And then the licensing of exports of nuclear reactors in their entirety, and U.S. government cooperation with other countries involving nuclear energy R&D. Almost all of those are relevant to the situation with Korea. So the 1-2-3 agreement refers to Section 1-2-3 of the Atomic Energy Act, which requires all this. So they're often called 1-2-3 agreements. So the U.S.-South Korea 1-2-3 agreement that's currently in force was signed in 1972 to go for 30 years, but it was later amended to extend for 41 years, so now it expires March 18th, I think. It's like the end of March 18th, and then March 19th will be the first day that it's not enforced. So that's sort of the deadline
yeah.
to get it done again.
Wanting to know more about why South Korea needed to renegotiate the 123 agreement, I asked Dr. Song Ho Shin of Seoul National University to explain more.
I think this current existing nuclear agreement was agreed about 40 years ago. And so over the past four decades, South Korea has developed its nuclear capacity in a very impressive way. So I think they would like to reflect upon those that kind of South Korea's growing nuclear capacity, and but more specifically with regard to the enrichment issue, they have a more specific economic reason why they want to get that capacity for their own. First, they do have at the moment about 23 nuclear reactors, of which 19 light water reactors, which uses low enriched uranium. And they are depending on those nuclear fuel for completely on the import from the foreign country. And with about 20 nuclear reactors that needs the nuclear fuel, they figure that it's much more economic for them to supply, to have a supply capacity of their own nuclear fuel rather than importing from outside. The second issue has to do with South Korea's ambition to become a major exporters of nuclear reactors to the world. And indeed, in 2009, they agreed with UAE about exporting four South Korean nuclear reactors to the country. And they want to do it so with more country in the future. And to become major exporters, they would like to make sure that they have the capacity to give a complete guarantee to those customers, which includes the capacity to supply nuclear fuel. So I think that's two reasons why the South Koreans is very much interested in this nuclear enrichment capacity at the moment.
Although Mark Holt recognizes Professor Sheen's argument that South Korea has legitimate economic motivations to acquire enrichment and reprocessing capabilities, he also points out that the US believes Seoul has nothing to be worried about when it comes to purchasing fuel supplies in the medium to long-term future.
Well, the, South Korea is in an sort of a unique position. I mean, South Koreans are arguing they are the largest nuclear power producing country that does not have its own enrichment capability. And so the rule of thumb that's been put forth is once you have about 20 operating commercial power reactors, that's an economically viable number to actually support a domestic enrichment program. So presumably they could support such a program, you know, and it would be economically viable. Now, the United States would certainly argue that South Korea already has plenty of sources of enrichment for its fuel, and there is plenty of supply on the world market, you know, for the known future, and there's quite a number of projects that are waiting in the works, especially in the United States, that could potentially, and that are independent from one another, that could sign competitive contracts for the supply on a commercial basis. And so the United States, I think, is arguing that South Korea does not have anything to worry about as far as supply, but the South Koreans are not only worried about supply for their domestic market, they're especially concerned about, this is for enrichment, potential supply for their own exports of nuclear power. And they are arguing that they are at a competitive disadvantage because if they are putting forth a proposal to export a reactor to a country that doesn't have nuclear power, that they are not able to offer the entire package of fuel services that would go along with that reactor. And some of their competitors, most notably Areva of France, can offer that. Now, the United States would come back and say, well, that's maybe true, but it may not be the deciding factor of South Koreans' big signature export project, their very first one, to the United Arab Emirates, UAE, they did go head-to-head against Areva and won, even though they didn't have the fuel services.
But it's not just interest in developing a guaranteed energy supply for the domestic market or being able to offer enriched uranium to clients in the international sphere. South Korea also says it needs reprocessing for peaceful research purposes, as Professor Sheen explains.
South Korea is interested in developing a next generation nuclear energy producing technology. To do so, they need a certain capacity to do the experiment on this reprocessing. But at the moment, they are strictly prohibited, even for the research purpose, to be engaged in any kind of reprocessing. So I think that's their interest at the moment, to have at least a very limited or minimum capacity to execute certain research in developing next generation nuclear reactors.
So could South Korean research and reprocessing in next-generation nuclear reactors be of benefit to the United States? Gordon Flake explained.
If you're looking at this from the perspective of the nuclear energy industry, and you've seen the United States now have decades of struggle with its own domestic market, and you're looking at it from the perspective of the Japanese, another country that's kind of akin to us in terms of having a private sector-led industry, clearly, there's energy and drive on the part of the South Koreans that has the promise, renewing, nuclear energy as an option, particularly in the context of global climate change, etc. And so, if South Korea can, work together with these integral, fast reactors, smaller reactors, can make pyroprocessing work on a commercial basis going forward, then that's something that would certainly benefit the United States as well, which is precisely why I think you've seen the United States agree already to this 10-year joint study with South Korea in terms of pyroprocessing and these integral fast reactors.
While those are just some potential economic advantages, a recent Korea Electric Power Corporation nuclear plant sale to the UAE showed just how American companies can directly benefit from participation in Korean export projects. In particular, that case led to profits of approximately $1 billion for US-based company Westinghouse. But at the same time, the UAE project is illustrative of some of the competition that US nuclear suppliers could face from Korea. But that's not all. Gordon Flake also warns,
it's difficult to say today that there are guaranteed economic benefits, or that there would be economic benefits, because again, the back end of the fuel cycle, if you will, has proven to be extremely troublesome for all countries who have been involved with it. And that's not even talking about questions of long-term storage or the lack thereof. So it's one of these issues where the nuclear industry, perhaps more than any other industry in history, has been one where there have been long been promises of economic nirvana at the end of the road, and yet they really haven't borne out. It's been proven to be very, very expensive. And so South Korea right now is very confident, and there's potential there, but there's also the potential that, just like in the case of Japan, in the case of the United States, or the case of Great Britain, that this is going to be highly expensive, and much more so than the South Koreans anticipate. So I would be hesitant to say this is something where it's a sure bet economically. There's promise, but also peril.
But despite promise of a technological breakthrough in the nuclear field and strong South Korean economic imperatives, non-proliferation expert Mark Fitzpatrick sees no need to change the current 123 agreement in South Korea's favor.
I don't think that South Korea needs to enrich uranium. It's been able to obtain all the enriched uranium it needs for its civil nuclear program from the international marketplace, and there's no prospect of any change in the availability of such fuel. I don't think that South Korea needs reprocessing. There are better ways in the interim to take care of spent fuel through interim storage than embarking on would be a tremendously expensive and politically and diplomatically difficult technology of reprocessing, or as South Korea calls it, their variation of that, pyroprocessing. I don't think that the 123 agreement is going to provide for either uranium enrichment or plutonium reprocessing. I know that South Korea wants that very much, So far, the United States has not agreed to it, and I think the United States should continue to say no.
But why? As a close ally of the United States, why should Washington be trying to prevent South Korea from developing its own enrichment or reprocessing capabilities when other American friends like Japan and India have long had these technologies?
I think the answer to that is that the policy of the United States to restrict the expansion of these sensitive technologies is not at all directed at South Korea. It's a global policy. And it happened to come into play after Japan already got into the club. But if an exception is made for South Korea, it's hard to not make exceptions for other countries. Nonproliferation policies should be applied universally, both to adversaries and to friends. If they're applied universally, they have the strength of fairness and legitimacy. So despite what I recognize are South Korea's good arguments for pursuing it, I think there are better arguments not to, and that South Korea should not feel that it's being treated badly when the United States says, sorry, on this one, we can't do it.
But does that just mean that the United States doesn't trust South Korea with these sensitive nuclear technologies in its hands? Professor Song Ho-shi explains.
I think it basically comes down to the issue of trust, right? How much the U.S. Can trust South Korea's intention. And of course, in that sense, there's no way that I can tell you what will happen in 50 years. But I think United States, even though it was under a little different context, allowed already in the past the Japan to go on with its own enrichment and reprocessing capacity, meaning that the U.S. has a full confidence and trust about Japan's in not, you know, using this right as a weapon, you know, developing capacity. So I think from South Korean perspective, if U.S. can trust Japan, why they cannot trust South Korea, which is another important ally in Asia and as well as in the global, you know, security arena these days.
But while some might agree with what Professor Sheen says, Mark Fitzpatrick thinks otherwise.
You know, I understand the argument that is made. It's kind of like gun control in the United States. There's one body of thought that says it's not the guns, it's the people. So don't restrict guns, just restrict the bad people and let the good people have guns. And the other philosophy is that when guns get circulated, they often can get into the wrong hands or people can change. So restrict the supply of guns. I think a similar sort of philosophy, I mean, not a very good analogy, but you get the point. You know, these sensitive nuclear technologies that lead to the development of nuclear weapons are something the United States, as the leader of the nonproliferation global regime, should be intent on maintaining. Now, the United States has made exceptions before, and I think it was a mistake when the United States granted exceptions to India on grounds that India was a friend, and certainly it's a democracy and has a good record and all that. But once you make an exception to India, then Pakistan wants the same exception. And then Pakistan argues that because it doesn't get the same exception, it's not going to go along with a negotiation of a treaty on a cutoff of fissile material production. So Pakistan stonewalls the FMCT. In other words, there are secondary consequences to allowing exceptions. And in the case of South Korea, you know, if there were no secondary consequences, one could make a case that, okay, let's go along with it. But I think that breaking the rules and allowing exceptions can get you into trouble, and one should just maintain the rules.
When I put what Mark was saying to Professor Sheen, he seemed to understand.
Maybe it's not about South Korea's intention per se. Maybe the U.S. is more concerned about its implication for other countries and its global non-proliferation efforts. What kind of message this will send if U.S. allows this specific rise to the South Korea, and what if other country come to the U.S. for, say, let's say, for example, the Iran thing. It's a double standard, right? I mean, they could say so, obviously. So, yeah, I understand that the U.S. concern, but at the same time, from the South Korean, especially domestic public perception is that, again, still, this is about not between the U.S. and Korea, and this is a bilateral issue, and in that sense, they always, you know, try to say that U.S. need to give more respect for South Korea's growing capacity, not only as an ally, but also as a key producer of nuclear energy at the moment.
But Mark says that if the U.S. does say no, it's not due to disrespect to South Korea's interest.
That saying no does not undermine America's support for South Korea, support that's been expressed in so many ways, and most recently by giving South Korea a kind of exception to the missile technology control regime guidelines, increasing the range of what South Korea is allowed to develop with its missiles. So they got a pretty good deal with the change of rules for the missiles. I think South Korea should accept that on the reprocessing enrichment that the United States can't go along with what they want this time.
But beyond the more broad-ranging implications on the non-proliferation regime, Professor Sheen says that North Korea might be more of a sticking point.
I think that the North Korean issue is more important hurdle for this bilateral negotiation, because yes, obviously North Koreans must be, you know, watching this very carefully, as they did in the past. And I mean, for example, regarding this long-range missile or rocket, they always say South Korea is okay, you know, go and developing its own satellite. And they say their program is also satellite. It's not a long-range rocket missile. So if that's the case, obviously there is also the possibility that North Korea will do the same thing if U.S. allows South Korea certain enrichment or reprocessing capability. North Korea always can come back and saying that, look, and you did, you know, you gave that kind of permission to South Korea, and why can't we have the same right? And they can also argue that their also program is, you know, peaceful use of nuclear energy. After all, their first nuclear weapon program was claimed as, you know, a nuclear power plant. Now there's a nuclear weapon facility, right? So that's, I think that makes this negotiation very much difficult for both of the country. But again, the South Korea says position is that it has nothing to do with North Korea. I mean, this is a strictly bilateral issue between U.S. and South Korea, and this is strictly about the peaceful use of nuclear energy.
Given the understandable motivations for South Korea's desire to acquire uranium enrichment and plutonium processing, but cognizant of the potential effects on global non-proliferation and the particular case of North Korea, I asked Mark Holt to explain what would happen next in the process.
Well, I think the State Department has the lead on it. and they do have, obviously, people focused on this quite a bit. But I have not seen any specific proposals or actually know where they're at right now as far as trying to get something done by spring. And they're looking at spring of 2013 as the deadline to put something before the U.S. Congress because of the requirement in the Atomic Energy Act that the agreement lie before Congress for 90 days of continuous session. That means both the House and the Senate have to be in session for 90 days, which is never known to be exactly how long that will be, but by most calculations, that'll be, or by spring, that would give them enough time to have it lie 90 days before the expiration in March of 2014. And then if they go over that deadline and they miss don't get the 90 days, then presumably it would expire for a period of time. And that did happen with the Uratom Agreement in 1995. It expired at the end of the last day of 1995, even though the new agreement had already been negotiated. They ran out of time on the 90 days, and in fact, it didn't finally, the actual new agreement didn't take effect until April, so they had more than 3 months of a gap at that time. And but knowing that they had a new agreement in place, there were no major substantive problems, except that there was some controversy in Congress, and there were hearings in Congress. So it wasn't a universally accepted agreement. There were people in Congress who had serious problems with it. But they did eventually. Congress does not have to pass it. They just have to not do anything. And right. Congress just allowed it to go into effect anyway.
One thing that could work in Seoul's favor with Congress and the State Department is South Korea's stellar work in promoting nuclear transparency and security, even if Mark Fitzpatrick warns that more could be done.
I think South Korea really should be applauded for its leadership recently. The hosting of the 2012 Nuclear Security Summit was an outstanding gesture of friendship to President Obama by President Im Jong-bak, and an outstanding demonstration of South Korea's global role, volunteering for the role and then carrying it out so well. It was just tremendously well done. And South Korea is now very involved in the plans for the next nuclear security summit to be held in The Hague in 2014. So continuing that goal, that role, South Korea has been playing a leadership role in the development of a nuclear security center of excellence, and then cooperating with Japan and China, who also have centers of excellence, to share ideas to avoid duplication and to create a synergy that's greater than the sum of the parts. There are some ways, though, that South Korea can contribute even more than it has been. And one would be by increasing the transparency in its own nuclear program. South Korea's nuclear program of late has had some embarrassing examples of shoddy adherence to transparency rules and to allowing companies to skate by on safety by not adhering to strict performance guidelines. South Korea's got a little bit of house cleaning to do here. I'm not pointing the finger particularly at South Korea, but we all know there's more that it needs to be done to bring its own standards up to world world leadership standards.
So given the potential for impasse, to conclude, I asked Mark Holt to explain some of the potential options available to both South Korea and the U.S.
There are options that have been discussed, I don't know if discussed officially by the parties, but discussed by observers and analysts and generally non-governmental people who are following it. I mean, you've had the two extremes. Either one side or the other gives in. Obviously, that would solve the problem, presumably. But there are possibilities in the middle. One might involve the 10-year feasibility study, for example, to put off any U.S. advance consent for reprocessing until the 10-year study is done, or even have the entire agreement only last, and it'd be another eight or 9 years or so until this feasibility is done. Maybe have the whole agreement come up again at that time, or just the reprocessing part come up again. Something like that. On the enrichment, there's nothing in the works quite the same as the feasibility study, so that might take a little bit more creativity to come up with a middle ground there, but maybe something involving supply guarantees or something like that. But I haven't seen any specific ideas there. But hopefully there is some room for some kind of middle ground.
But whether the outcome is a middle ground, a result that favors South Korea, or one in which the U.S. chooses not to yield, Professor Sheen warns that whatever happens, the outcome should not become a test case for the alliance.
the one key thing for the two countries at the moment engaged in this very important bilateral issue is that this nuclear 1-2-3 agreement should not become a test case for the alliance. And over the past years, there was a beef issue, there was a U.S. close FTA, and these things, these issues was very important. And for that matter, it could be easily become a kind of the politicized and domestic political issue. And so the two governments should be very careful that they come up with a more constructive agreement on this to promote future use of peaceful use of nuclear energy as well as non-proliferation regime. But at the same time, they should really make an effort to use this as an opportunity to upgrade the alliance and the bilateral relations, not make this as a test case for the alliance.
Having discussed all the pros and cons, I asked Gordon Flake outright if he thought that South Korea should be entitled to enrichment and reprocessing capabilities, and what he thought the likely outcome would be as we move forward.
This is obviously a very sensitive issue, because there is a global effort led by the United States, but not just the United States, a global effort to reduce the amount of reprocessing that goes on in the world, to kind of restrict the fuel cycle. And this has been born of a recognition that the non-proliferation treaty itself has increasingly become weakened, and that states like Iran can still remain within the good graces, technically, of their obligations under the non-proliferation treaty, and yet reprocess up to the point where they're just at the point of being able to have nuclear weapons, and yet not kind of cross that line. And so I think there's been, a global effort, has nothing to do with Korea, to try to roll that back, to try to restrict the number of states that are actually reprocessing. It's also important to note that the United States itself doesn't reprocess. We find it non-economical. In fact, I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that it's difficult to find any country in the world that has found reprocessing to be an economical approach to dealing with nuclear waste. And so in that context, clearly there are some people in the U.S. who are deeply concerned both for reasons non-proliferation, for precedence, for global kind of standards and norms perspective, very hesitant to see South Korea, expanded to be a country that has, the global right, if you will, to reprocess its spent fuel. However, the fact that Japan already has that right, the fact that other countries have done it, and the fact that South Korea's nuclear program has been as successful as it has thus far, and that they're a global exporter, also kind of adds some weight on the other side for South Korea's perspective. Personally, I think there's almost no way out of it that there's going to have to be some expansion of the scope of South Korea's not only capability, but their role in reprocessing. I would be very surprised to see it happen where South Korea has full reprocessing rights right now up front. But clearly, as they continue to work together with the United States on pyroprocessing and other issues, that this is something that I think will be revisited in a relatively short time frame, not necessarily a 20 or 30 or 40 year lifespan of a nuclear cooperation agreement. And if you're looking at it from the energy perspective, if anybody can do it, South Korea can. I mean, clearly they've shown an ability to come in under budget, on time, with their projects, whereas that is something that has bedeviled the United States and Japan. So, I'm evading the question. It's not an easy answer to give, but it is one that is highly sensitive, and it's much more complex between should they or shouldn't they. The question is really what are the implications if they do or they don't.
Whatever happens, we'll be watching progress on the 1-2-3 agreement closely in the coming weeks and months. Stay tuned to the KEIA website for more updates. I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.